afternoon. My name is Ashley, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the E-Verify conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Irma Herrera, you may begin your conference.
Thank you so much, Ashley. Good morning and good afternoon. Welcome to our participants located in various time zones around the country. The topic of today's call is the fiscal and political cost of a proposed national E-Verify program. My name is Irma Herrera with New American Media, and I am today's moderator. Please note that this telephone call is being recorded, and by participating, you consent to this recording. The audio of this telebriefing will be available at the conclusion of this call at the Center for American Progress's website at www.americanprogress.org. If you have any further questions with respect to today's briefing, please call 202-481-8181. I will provide this information again at the end of the call. Last month, Texas Congressman Lamar Smith, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, introduced the Legal Workforce Act, H.R. 2164. This bill would make E-Verify, the federal government's internet-based work authorization system, mandatory for all employers in the United States. The Center for American Progress recently released a report that quantifies the range of damaging outcomes posed by a national mandatory E-Verify program. Smith's bill also jeopardizes the possibility of adopting comprehensive immigration reform. The report, titled Seen and Mostly Unseen, the True Cost of E-Verify, was prepared by Philip Wolgen, immigration policy analyst at the Center for American Progress, who is one of today's two presenters. Currently, E-Verify is used by only 4% of U.S. businesses. Wolgen's report examines how this program has been implemented and the problems created for both employees and employers, and quantifies the expected cost if implemented nationally. We are very pleased to have Angela Kelly on this call also. Angela is the Vice President for Immigration Policy and Advocacy at the Center for American Progress. We will start today's telebriefing with Angela Kelly's overview of the immigration political landscape on Capitol Hill and beyond, and H.R. 2164's potentially hazardous effects on the prospects for much-needed comprehensive immigration reform. Angela?
Thanks very much, Irma, and thanks very much to your organization, the New America Media, for organizing this terrific call, and everyone for joining, particularly those who may be soccer fans, and I know that this call is taking place while the U.S. is battling France in the semifinals of the World Cup, but we'll try to get through the call quickly so that folks can get back to the game if you're watching it, and I won't tell you what the score is. So, Irma, that was a terrific introduction to this bill, which many are predicting is going to sail through the House of Representatives in the coming months. And I just wanted to give people a little bit of a, you know, context of how the bill is likely to move, what its prospects are in the Senate, and then really to lay out for you kind of three interesting points to watch as this debate unfolds. And then I'll turn the call over to my colleague, Phil, who will be able to walk you through really the content and some of the major concerns around the E-Verify proposal. So as Irma indicated, this bill was recently introduced by Lamar Smith. He introduced it with 30 co-sponsors. That means that there's 30 other House members, all Republicans, who have joined him in supporting the bill. The bill is going to be considered by the House Judiciary Committee, and that's process where the bill is debated in committee and amendments are offered and the bill is could be changed. It's called a markup. And a markup of the Lamar Smith bill could happen not next week but the week after. It has not been officially scheduled. And in fact, over several weeks, we thought that the bill was going to be discussed and debated in committee, marked up, as I said, and then it's been postponed. So for varying reasons, which we can get into in the Q&A, the bill is not yet scheduled. But I'm certain that it will be, because Congressman Lamar Smith, a Republican from San Antonio who chairs the committee, has made it very clear that this is the central piece of his platform, if you will, on immigration enforcement. And we should be clear that since the Republicans have taken control of the House this year, that is the only type of immigration proposals that they want to pursue. There have been a number of hearings. They have all been about enforcement measures. There have been a number of bills been introduced by Republicans, and every single one of them is only about enforcement, and none are about trying to get a handle on a broken immigration system and pursuing a more comprehensive approach that would deal, for example, with the 11 million who are here without status. So we can expect that this bill will be marked up or debated, and I will come out of committee. The Republicans control the Judiciary Committee. There are more Republican votes than Democratic votes. So we can expect that the Republicans will probably all support this measure in committee. And then the next step for the bill would be to go to the House floor, where the entire House of Representatives could debate and discuss the bill and then vote on it. And it's not at all clear when that will happen. Congress traditionally is not in session in the month of August. So if that's the case, this would be if they can get it through committee in July, which they probably can. This bill would maybe come up in September. But there are a lot of reasons that make the timing unclear, what other bills and other business the House has to do, what the reaction was to the bill during the Judiciary Committee, how contentious was the markup. And then another factor about whether this bill will make it to the House floor or when it will make it is the reaction by outside stakeholders. And that's why I think this call is so important, since most of you are ethnic press reporters, and this is of particular importance to the to ethnic communities across the USA and to immigrant communities. So those are some of the factors. We don't know when the House bill will go to the House floor, but let's just say for argument's sake it'll probably be in the fall. And if Lamar Smith is able to keep the Republicans in agreement with this bill, it is a bill that would probably pass. Democrats' reaction to the bill has largely been negative, that the bill doesn't solve the problem by not dealing with the undocumented workforce in this country. You're just simply pushing them further underground. And again, we can talk more about that in the Q&A. On the Senate side, the Senate is, of course, controlled by Democrats. Harry Reid is the leader, and he has been clear that E-Verify alone wouldn't solve our broken immigration system. So Senate action in the form of Senator Reid bringing this bill right to the floor is very unlikely. But that doesn't mean that there won't be efforts by Republican senators when the Senate is considering another measure to try to add an E-Verify bill to another bill as an amendment. And if that's the case, it would most likely require 60 votes by the Republicans to try to add E-Verify, which means that we would need 41 to stop E-Verify from being added on in the Senate. While you can never be sure of anything in Washington or how votes are going to come out, I do think it would be probably a tough lift for Republicans in the Senate to get that much support for an E-Verify proposal because of some of the problems, which my colleague Phil will be explaining shortly. And then just as a final point, I think this debate is interesting for a number of reasons, but I would really urge reporters to try to look at it in the coming months through three perspectives. One is to consider this enforcement proposal and its ultimate goal of really making adding to the enforcement arsenal that's already quite large and making it inhospitable and unsustainable for immigrants in this country, pushing them further deeper underground. If this passes, this is very much the heart of the enforcement agenda, and if this passes without something for the 7 or 8 million unauthorized workers in this country who won't leave. They'll just go deeper underground. They'll get paid under the table. They'll be exploited more. You've really driven a stake through the heart of comprehensive immigration reform. And if E-Verify passes, I would find it very difficult to imagine that we would at any later point, any time in the years to come, be able to get simply a legalization program. So these two measures, E-Verify and legalization, that have really been the heart of comprehensive immigration reform, the yin and the yang, if you will. If they're torn apart, then I don't see an easy revival or a revival at all of something to do for the folks who are here without status. So that's one point, just to see how that debate unfolds. And the second point is really an interesting one regarding Republicans, because if you step back and you look at the E-Verify program, and this I think will take on more meaning after you hear Phil's presentation, this is a huge government program. This is a program that, contrary to what Republicans say, is going to result in Americans losing jobs. 770,000 Americans will lose their jobs because of this program. Not unauthorized to work Americans, but people who are either born here or who are authorized to work. You'll have an increase in the deficit because you will lose tax dollars, $17.3 billion over 10 years, as scored by the Congressional Budget Office of a similar bill just a few years ago. And again, Phil will go through these numbers with you. But where you hear Republicans wanting to talk about shrinking the deficit and making sure Americans have jobs, this is a program that would do exactly the opposite. Also, contrary to Republicans' typical concern about small businesses, as we all are, this is a program that would cost small businesses $2.6 billion a year. Huge expense. This would break the backs of small businesses, which are really very much the heart and the muscle and the brains, if you will, of what drives this country's economy. And then finally, cutting the size of government. That's something that you hear Republicans say all the time. This is a program that would result in a massive expansion of government, where the government would have to, DHS, for example, would have to spend about $800 million just to be able to get this program up and going, and that is considered to be a very modest estimate. The Social Security Administration, an already taxed government agency, would be taxed with having to do more work, $281 million, again, having to come out of the Social Security Administration's pocket, the government's pocket, over a five-year period to be able to run mandatory E-Verify. So these are very contrary to Republicans' core principles that they always claim to be about protecting jobs, shrinking the deficit, supporting small businesses, and cutting the size of government. And they're going in exactly the opposite direction. So I urge you, as you're talking to lawmakers and supporters of E-Verify, that they're very much challenged on how do they square their principles against the circle that is E-Verify. And then a final point has to do with how Republicans within their party, I believe, will have some fights about this. There will be some intra-Republican fights, and we're already beginning to see this, where Congressman Lou Barletta, who was a famous mayor of Hazleton, Pennsylvania, that was really one of the godfathers of anti-immigrant initiatives, you know, he immediately shot off a letter after Lamar Smith introduced this bill and said, wait a minute, you know, you're doing this kind of legislation. We think the states should be able to do an E-Verify bill. It shouldn't be the federal government doing it. And even Chris Kobach, who is a very well-known anti-immigrant advocate, was also similarly critical of the legislation. So you see within the Republican Party fighting already beginning to happen. I think you'll see more of that, particularly as small businesses kind of wake up and smell the coffee and realize that this is going to be bad for them. And then again, as I mentioned before, really contrary to Republican principles. And finally, this very much drives a stake in the heart of comprehensive immigration reform for the 11 million without status. So those are some key points I think that you might want to keep in mind, and we're happy to talk about that more in the Q&A, and just in the months ahead, we'll be sure to give you our contact information. But now for the real content and kind of the meat of this presentation, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Phil Walgan. Phil?
Great. Thank you so much, Angie, Irma, and thank you all for being with us today. So I'm going to talk a bit about our recent report, Seen and Mostly Unseen, the true costs of E-Verify, and specifically the high cost to individuals, to small businesses, and to the federal government from using E-Verify. And the bottom line, is, as Angie has really pointed out, is that without a fully legal workforce, E-Verify is too expensive. It imposes costly mandates on businesses, it taxes individuals, and costs the government a significant amount of money. And you know, in these fragile economic times, we really just can't afford it. So I'll start by discussing how E-Verify works, what exactly it is, and then detail the different costs. Let's start with the basics. E-Verify is the government's internet-based system that allows employers to check if their employees are legally authorized to work or eligible to work in the country. And as Irma pointed out, about 4% of businesses in America currently use it, and it's not mandatory for most employers. But if the Legal Workforce Act passes, we're talking about scaling up a program from only 4% of businesses to 100% of businesses. And really, I mean, if you employ even one person, you'd have to use the system. So as it currently works, when you as an employer hire a new worker, you submit the employee's eligibility information over the internet. And this information can include things like name, birthday, social security or alien ID number, and citizenship status. Then the Social Security Administration and U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services check this data against the record. If everything matches up, the employer receives instant proof of work authorization. The problem comes in when there's a mismatch between the information that's submitted and the government records. When this happens, E-Verify issues what is known as a tentative non-confirmation, or TNC. When a TNC has been issued, the burden then falls to the worker to sort out. He or she has to actually contact the government, go out of their way to contact the government and fix the issue. And if they fail to do so, or if they can't fix the information mismatch, then E-Verify issues what's known as a final non-confirmation. And employers are required to fire anybody who receives one of these final non-confirmations. I'll say here that while under the law, employers can't discriminate against anyone until they receive this final non-confirmation, we know from experience that many employers do actually go out of their way and either demote or fire people who get the earlier step, the tentative non-confirmation. For legally authorized workers, the system is fairly accurate, between 99.7 and 99% accurate. But I say only fairly accurate because, as Angie pointed out, we know from past experience that close to 750,000 legally authorized American workers will be incorrectly deemed to be unauthorized because of government errors and will ultimately lose their jobs. So that's 750,000 American jobs lost because of mandatory E-Verify. And we also know that these errors disproportionately fall on the foreign-born. Naturalized citizens, for example, are 30 times more likely to receive a tentative non-confirmation than somebody born in this country. And while E-Verify is fairly accurate when it comes to authorized workers, it fails to detect unauthorized workers more than half of the time. So to put that in context, more than 50% of all unauthorized workers who are put through the system have no problem gaining proof of work authorization because the system just cannot detect identity fraud. So let's talk about the costs of E-Verify. For individual employees, for the people accessing the system as workers, there are two main costs associated with the system: the cost of getting an appropriate photo identification and the cost to resolve a tentative non-confirmation, where E-Verify indicates that an employee's information doesn't match government records. Unlike the current employment verification process through the I-9 forms, an employee must have a valid photo identification to be checked through E-Verify, and that is to say that employers can only accept a photo ID as proof that the employee is who he or she says they are. And we estimate that 750,000 people in the U.S. don't have this type of ID, and that it will cost them $225 of their own money in lost wages and transportation costs and the cost of the ID just to be able to be run through the system. On top of the cost to an ID, 1 to 3.5 million Americans, and these are people legally authorized to work in this country, will receive a tentative non-confirmation in error, and will have to travel to a government office to fix the problem. We estimate that it will cost an average of $190 in lost wages and travel time to get the proper work authorization for these people. So altogether, for unlucky individuals who need both a photo ID and have to fix government database errors, would have to pay $415 of their own money, all to work in a job they've already secured. And for small businesses, the costs for using E-Verify are even higher. And small businesses in particular shoulder really the biggest challenges in using E-Verify. According to a recent Bloomberg government study, E-Verify would have cost small businesses $2.6 billion last year had it been mandatory, at an average cost of $435 per business. And these businesses really make up the vast majority of American businesses, close to 98% of all American employers. And these are the businesses that have created two-thirds of net new jobs over the last 15 years. So these are really critical, critical parts of the American economy. We also know that the first-year startup costs for E-Verify can be far higher, over $1,000 for even the smallest of employers. So one major question that we want to ask is, you know, just how many businesses will be unable to open because of the incredibly high startup costs from E-Verify? And finally, E-Verify will cost the federal government a significant amount of money as well. According to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, E-Verify would cost $17.3 billion over 10 years in decreased tax revenue, mainly because the unauthorized workers that are caught by the system don't simply leave the country, but move into the cash economy where they're more open to exploitation from their employers and where their tax revenue doesn't accrue to the federal government. On top of this lost revenue, again, as Angie pointed out, operating E-Verify will cost the government at least $1 billion over the next 5 years between the Social Security Administration and U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. And these estimates have been deemed by the nonpartisan Government Accountability Office to be only partially accurate because they really don't take into account the full range of problems that putting together such a comprehensive, mandatory E-Verify program could have. So the true cost might be far higher than this $1 million figure. So to sum up then, E-Verify can cost individuals up to $415 of their own money, cost small businesses $2.6 billion per year, and the federal government $17.3 billion in lost tax revenue, as well as a minimum of $1 billion over 5 years to run. And this is all for a system that will rob Americans of their jobs and fail to catch unauthorized workers more than half of the time. No one should have to lose their jobs because of government errors, nor should we be burdening our nation's small business job creators, especially in these already shaky economic times. So instead of implementing this as a mandatory program, the better solution, we believe, would be to pair E-Verify, as Angie pointed out, with a program that ensures a fully legal workforce and to phase it in gradually and make sure that it's 100% accurate before we make and we force small businesses and individuals into the system. These measures would cut down on identity fraud, would reduce costs, and would lead to higher accuracy rates. But the key piece is to have a fully legal workforce. Instead of kicking unauthorized workers off the tax rolls where they can't contribute to tax revenue, we need a tough but fair process of earned legalization that brings all workers into the legal system. And I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Angela Kelly and Philip Olgan, both with the Center for American Progress. Ashley, could you please provide the instructions again to our listeners on how they queue up for questions?
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
And while we're waiting for the questions to queue up, I'll remind you that this teleconference call is being recorded, and by participating, you consent to this recording. At the end of the telebriefing, this call will be available at www.americanprogress.org. And if you have further questions with respect to today's briefing, they can be reached at area code 202-481-8181.
Your first question comes from the line of Vidya Pradhan with India Current Magazine.
Yes, thank you. This is very illuminating. I have actually two questions. The first is, some states have already made it mandatory for businesses, the local businesses, to do the E-Verify program. So do we have any data from them about how the program is working now that it is mandatory? And my second question is, you know, we've been talking about the costs of E-Verify, but I don't think there's any disagreement that it's a policy that's not a bad policy. It's just that it needs to be done in tandem with legalizing the workforce, because it seems that if we do that anyway, if we're going to legalize the workforce and then do this, the costs are going to be incurred in any case. We may make up some of the cost from the, I mean, we wouldn't have the lost tax revenues, but other than that, the implementation would still take up all those costs. So what are we really fighting for? Are we fighting for not having E-Verify, or are we fighting for having E-Verify in conjunction with a more comprehensive program? And thank you.
So those are great questions. Phil, why don't you take what we know from experience, particularly from Arizona, and then I'll take the other question about are we for E-Verify or not?
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a really, really great question. We do have some data, some from Arizona and some from Los Angeles County, which has been using the system for a number of years and did a really big study on what was happening. In Arizona, one of the things they found that even after mandatory E-Verify, a lot of employers simply weren't using the system. But one thing they really did find, and this is kind of goes off of the lost government revenue, is that a good number of people were kicked off the rolls. That is, that it caught some portion of unauthorized workers, but that these workers simply moved into the underground economy. So Arizona's tax revenues did actually decrease. And that's something that the Congressional Budget Office feels will happen on the federal level as well across the country, that these are not people who are going to leave the country, but that it's actually going to be detrimental. L.A. County, I think, is a really interesting case, because when they ran the system, they actually got pretty high error rates. So I mentioned that we know 1 to 3.5 million people will end up having these tentative non-confirmation errors. And according to the federal government, well, they have the far lower error rate in their kind of official studies of the program, saying that, you know, only 0.8% of all legally authorized workers have an issue. But when LA County actually went out and looked at what's happening on the ground in their county, they found a much higher error rate of 2.3%. And again, 2.3%, these might sound like very small numbers, but when you scale those up to the 154 million plus people working in the United States, that's a significant number of Americans who will lose their jobs or who will have to spend a lot of their own money to go fix the problem.
Great. And then to your question about E-Verify as an enforcement measure, do we support it or not? And your analysis is spot on. E-Verify is something that the Center for American Progress and a number of organizations that follow this issue closely are supportive of. And it's only in the context, as you so correctly suggested, of dealing with the unauthorized workers in the U.S. And taking into account 8 million undocumented workers, and E-Verify alone will result in them just being moved off the books and into an underground economy, and that's why you have such huge numbers of dollars lost in tax revenue. So that would be, if you were to do this in the context of a legalization program, you wouldn't lose that revenue. If you were to do E-Verify also where you're ensuring data accuracy and where you're phasing it in with evaluation of its performance, then you wouldn't see the kinds of high numbers that Phil is talking about of people who would lose their jobs. And so there are ways that we think we can protect workers from misuse of the system, and it would be in how it's implemented, what kinds of benchmarks would be required, what kind of accuracy rates would be required. But really, central to it working would be that you're dealing with the unauthorized workforce, and that's just a place that the Republicans have refused to go. But there is no disagreement that in order to have an effective immigration system, we do have to have at point of hire a verification. It makes the most sense that we do it there. And if this debate were happening in the context of comprehensive reform, then I would suggest that many of the dollars that are being spent in other enforcement programs would perhaps not need to be spent in those programs, again, resulting in a savings. But unfortunately, given the makeup of the House of Representatives, we're not having that broader debate, which would really, you know, force us to examine what kinds of policies make the most sense and what are most cost effective.
Thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Ashwa K. Swapan with India List newspaper.
Hello. I would like either of you or both, if you wanted to address more the politics of this whole issue. And here's the way I see it. Essentially, this is a time of a bad economy, and consequently, there's substantial anti-immigrant sentiment. But the real challenge is, I think, that how polarized people are in this country. And so, you know, those who are anti-immigrant are not listening to these arguments, probably. But to focus more on the immigrant community itself, I've been reporting on the Indian-American community for 20 years. And what strikes me is that even within the community, you have the affluent Indians who have much greater visibility now, are in touch with congressmen, senators. But on the other hand, they themselves are quite removed from immigration issues. And I think the challenge is to reach within immigrant communities and make the case that it matters to them. So I'd like your views on that.
Irma, you want to comment on that, or you want me to take it?
Go ahead.
Just a comment on what to think about this.
Okay, and just to be sure I understand the question, it's how do we get immigrant communities to care about this issue, and isn't the debate so polarized, how will we ever unstick it? Is that the question?
Yeah, sort of, in a sense that even within the Indian communities, at least in the Indian community, I see a very, very clear divide. You have, you know, the affluent part of the community, which is very keyed into politics and has a lot of connections with congressmen and senators, but they do not consider these issues their very own. They are more concerned about, you know, ties between India and U.S. and so forth.
Okay. Yeah, and it may just be the different perspectives from, you know, the perches from which we watch this debate unfold. You know, I'm more familiar with the Latino community, for example. Both of my parents are from South America, and that tends to be a perspective that gets represented quite a bit because of the changing demographics and the growing number, particularly of Latino voters. And while I think this issue of E-Verify has been a little bit of a sleeper issue, because, you know, the bill was just introduced and it doesn't in some ways seem very controversial, I do think it's one that's going to begin to gather steam in the community, and you are going to see a response, particularly as people come to understand the impact it has on comprehensive reform. There's very good polling that's been done by Latino Decisions, for example, and again, I'm just talking about the Latino community. They poll Latino voters, and in the last few weeks came out with yet another poll that shows that immigration has exceeded the economy as a top concern for the Hispanic community. So immigration is, I think, very much central to a growing number of Latino voters when they think about, not because they themselves are undocumented, obviously they're voters, but because of the other point you were making, that the tone of the debate has gotten increasingly ugly. It's very heated. And I think the sweep of the proposals, the depth of something like SB 1070 in Arizona, you know, isn't any more about just undocumented people. It really does begin, I think, to make all Latinos feel uncomfortable, unwanted, and it becomes an inhospitable climate, which is also something that we've done some research in because that has economic consequences. And I guess that would be my final point, that, you know, as emotional as people might get about an issue like immigration, which I understand that it can push a lot of buttons, and, you know, we could talk about that, there is concern about people's pocketbooks. that trumps even that. And so in a state like Kentucky, for example, that was considering an anti-immigrant Arizona-like law, it didn't get anywhere because they looked at what it would cost, $40 million a year, and people in Kentucky realized, okay, we can do other things that are much better for our state's economy than spend $40 million trying to identify whether somebody's undocumented or not. And so you do see a number of states recognizing, even where they pass a law, like in Georgia, that there's some serious economic consequences to it. And that is, I think, the combination of those two threads, where you have a growing immigrant and ethnic group like Latinos, but also growing number of Asians and others that are becoming of age. We have 500,000 Latinos a year that are naturalizing or turning 18. That's 500,000 a year. That's a huge voting block. So you've got that thread, and they care about this issue, juxtaposed with Americans who may not be Latino, but who care about their pocketbook and are seeing that some of these proposals just go too far, they cost too much money, and they don't work. And I think that those two tracks running along together, I think, will ultimately get us to a better and, I think, a smarter debate.
Yeah.
Philip, any comments on that?
No, I mean, I think that's absolutely great. I mean, I would just add that, you know, specifically on E-Verify, just because it does so disproportionately fall on the foreign-born, mainly because, you know, in this type of system, all the information that's submitted by the employee has to match government records. And so the more times that changes, for example, through immigration, through marriage, if you change your name, through naturalization, every time there's another step in the system, there's more of a possibility that there will be some kind of error. And, you know, even an error of one letter means that you could end up getting caught by this system incorrectly and unfairly. And so I think it's something that certainly any community with a large population of foreign-born residents should be caring about, even if they're not now.
And again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from the line of Charles Erickson with News Service.
This is Charlie Erickson with Hispanic Link News Service. Yeah, I'd like to ask how it would cost $200 or $250 to get your picture taken and have somebody look at it. What was the breakdown of the costs on that?
Sure, sure. That's a really great question. Again, this is mainly $225 in lost wages and transportation. And so in America, the average transportation time to get to a DMV, and this is kind of a national average, is about 60 miles. And then you also have to figure that you're taking time out of work. So this is wages that you're not getting because you have to go to a DMV or a passport office or somewhere else and get that kind of ID, and then the cost of the identification itself.
Would you run by those numbers again? You have to go 60 miles?
Certainly.
What to do with a DMV, as you're saying? You can't bring a picture of yourself in?
Oh, no. Okay, that's a very good
question. You should contextualize that this is for people who don't have ID, so maybe back up a little bit.
Correct. Sure. So to use E-Verify, you have to have a government-issued photo identification to prove that you are who you say you are. So a passport or an alien card that has a picture ID, a driver's license, that sort of thing. It has to be an official government ID to work for the system. And, you know, to get one of those, we estimate that the average American will have to travel 60 miles round trip and have to take a day off, basically, to go and procure the actual ID.
Is there some study that shows those are the costs and those are the mileages that you're talking about?
Yes. Our numbers are coming from a government regulatory impact analysis for when E-Verify was proposed to be made mandatory for all federal workers. So they did a study basically on what it would cost, and I would be happy to provide that information. It's also in our report. We have the exact breakdown.
Okay.
Not a problem. I mean, I'd be happy to read you those numbers now, or I can point you to where it is.
Well, if anybody else is interested, go ahead and read them to us.
Certainly. So, okay, we estimate that the 60 miles round trip will cost $35.10 in using the federal government's rate. What they calculate at $5.08 a mile, more or less. The average cost of a photo ID, according to the government, is $35 in the U.S., and they estimate that an employee will have to take a full 8 hours of work to acquire the ID. Using the average wages in the U.S., that comes out to just over $154.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And again, this is for the segment of the population that doesn't have that don't have IDs. There is often this presumption that everybody's got a driver's license or everybody has a passport, and that's not the case.
One other point, for those of us who live in urban areas, we often drive by and see the DMVs, but in rural communities, you do have to go distances to reach your local DMV office.
Absolutely.
But most people who are looking for jobs generally try to live as close as possible as they can to where the jobs are, don't they? They're not going to go up in Eureka or someplace and try to get a job up there.
No, that's an excellent question. But it's not so much of living where the job is. It's living close to a place where you can get the appropriate identification.
Okay, yeah, it just seems to me there'd be sort of a thing that Smith might have a little fun with when you throw that number at him.
Well, we've got lots of other numbers he's going to have to deal with first.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Tom Cantlin with Daily Carrier.
Hi. Yeah, this is Tom Cantlin. I have two questions. One is look at it from a positive angle. Are there any proposals being put forth by either minority members in the House or Senate that are good proposals that could be held in contrast so that, kind of a target, a positive way of looking at it can be put forward? The other question is there documentation to make a convincing case on the idea that such a huge percentage of people who wouldn't be able to work would stay in the cash economy? Portion of people are not going to be able to do day labor and landscape work and stuff like that. So there would have to be a cash economy for kind of retail, white collar, those kinds of jobs that people have now that they would be kicked out of, that they would have to somehow continue in a cash economy. What documentation do we have for that?
Let me take the first question about, so what's the alternative vision? Senator Menendez, a Democrat from New Jersey, reintroduced a bill that he had introduced at the end of the last Congress that's been actually slightly modified, I think, to reflect this, this more recent debate around E-Verify, where E-Verify and legalization are paired as part of the first part of the bill. And I think, if you look at that piece of legislation, that really does try to deal with the unauthorized workers currently in the U.S., as well as how we would develop a system for people coming in the future, and smart enforcement measures. I mean, that to me is more the blueprint, if you will, of what would be an effective system. And similarly, interestingly, when the president made a speech in El Paso now several weeks ago, the White House issued a blueprint on immigration that, again, is, I think, a very clear proposal for what would make sense in an immigration system. And both of those measures deal with, as I've said, the 8 million unauthorized workers in the U.S., in addition to having an E-Verify program that's very robust, but I think manageable, and not the sort of, Smith E-Verify on steroids that is going to be considered in the Judiciary Committee. The second question, Phil, can you take that one?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I'm sure I can find the Menendez bill. I didn't see anything about the White House blueprint. Is there, you think of some more specific link I can use to find that? You said it was where?
It's on the White House website, I'm sure, and it's probably under their immigration tab. It was released the day of the El Paso speech.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, whitehouse.gov/issues, and then just scroll down to immigration. So to take your second question about documentation that people are staying in the cash economy, if I understand it correctly, it's basically a question of how do we know they're not just leaving? Is that correct?
Well, how do we substantiate that by making a case that there's a big enough cash economy for non-laborers?
Right. Excellent. Good. Yeah. So I'll answer that in two ways. The first is that from experience in Arizona, we know that after their state-level E-Verify bill, the Legal Arizona Workforce Act was passed in 2007, studies have shown that the vast majority of unauthorized immigrants stayed in the state. Something like 83% of those workers stayed in the state. Now, that doesn't mean that there is a big enough cash economy or not. It just means that people are staying. And, you know, this idea of people, especially unauthorized immigrants, staying in the country is some things that other groups have found as well. The Migration Policy Institute has done a number of studies looking at the effects of the recession on unauthorized populations. And what they found is that even as jobs are drying up all around and as the economy has gone downhill, unauthorized immigrants simply weren't leaving. They had ties here. Many of them had families and had been here for a while. And so I think the question is, yes, a lot of them are moving off of the books, but the bigger thing is that they're staying in the U.S.
Okay.
And the other, I guess the other way to approach it as well is that, and Phil, you gave the numbers on this, that in most cases, E-Verify doesn't actually catch, in quotation marks, the unauthorized worker. The unauthorized worker continues working and can get past an E-Verify because it's not, in fact, verifying accurately since they just have to show a document, and half the time they get through.
If I follow up with you, Philip, and on an email, can you provide me those studies you were referring to?
Absolutely.
Okay, I'll do that. Thank you.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Your next question comes from the line of Ann Hoyt with Group Hall Radio Central.
Hello. I understand that most of the businesses that are applying E-Verify now are actually government or contractors to the government, and even from those quarters there have been some complaints about how applying the system requires not only the money that you need to create the system, but you also have to train people, and there's like an 80-page manual that they have to, you know, that the employees that are going to use the system need to learn. And so there's also the added cost of training the employees that are going to apply the system. Could you comment on this, please?
Certainly, and I'll take that. I mean, I think that is a really, really big issue, and it's one of the reasons we are so concerned about the effects on small businesses. It's one thing for a firm with 10,000 employees and a full HR department to have somebody to do the training, to read through the manual. I think there's also a video you have to watch about the system. And currently, anybody who signs up has to sign a memorandum of understanding with the government about the system. So there are all these costs. The numbers that we cited, the $2.6 billion to small businesses and the startup costs of over $1,000 per year for even small businesses, those take into account the cost of training, of setting up the appropriate internet access, and everything you would need to use the system. But it is, I mean, it is very, very high.
But, I mean, is there do they keep a record of all the companies that have filed a complaint or, the different complaints that have been filed so far or the most common complaints?
I don't know.
Yeah, honestly, I don't. I'm not sure either. Yeah.
Mm. Okay, thank you.
And once again, to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from the line of Fabiola Puerta with El Mincero.
Hi, Hi. I have a question about the 8 million of undocumented workers you mentioned before. I just would like to know if they belong to a cash economy. I mean, how did you get this number? Are they people who work in it, or are they working in the formal economy, the informal economy? I would like to know about them. Thank you.
Sorry, I'm not.
You
if you could just repeat
question?
Which number? Yeah.
Excuse me, what did you say?
Could you please repeat the question? There's some background noise,
right,
and it was a little difficult to hear.
Yeah, you mentioned that there's an 8 million of undocumented workers, and I just would like to know about them. Who are they?
Oh.
Are they work pretty? Are they part of the cash economy? Are they working in the formal economy, in the informal economy? I just would like to know more about them. How do you get that number? That is me.
So the number of unauthorized folks in the U.S. and how many of them are workers and how many of them are children has been, well documented over the years. And probably the Pew Hispanic Center and Jeff Bissell is the most well-known demographer whose numbers very consistently match up with DHS's. And so I would direct you to the Pew Hispanic Center's website. And then he also has a breakdown of from what countries people come from, who are unauthorized, how many folks work, and in what kinds of industries. But I think that's probably the best source for all that data.
All right. Thank you.
And you do have a follow-up question from the line of Vidya Pradhan with India Current magazine.
Yes, hello. Actually, I wanted to know, are there any actionable items that you would like to suggest on this call? Of course, we'll be talking about this issue, but to ethnic media that is concerned about this uneven approach to immigration reform, is there something that you would suggest we do?
I mean, I think covering the issue is important. I think putting it in the broader context of if we do this, then what's the consequence for the other elements of immigration reform? What's the consequence to American workers, to authorized workers, to small businesses? So a lot of the seeds that we tried to plant on this call, we're hoping will be fruitful for you all. I think pressing lawmakers and asking them some of the questions of the issues we've raised is important. I don't think enough attention and scrutiny has been given to this program in isolation. It's been debated vigorously as a part of an overall debate in 2006 and 2007. But, as I said, this is a mandatory, vast expansion of a program that's been making slow but steady progress and is now being injected with steroids and being applied to everybody. And that's got some serious consequences. So I think talking to lawmakers about it and then writing about it and raising the issue as much as possible in your communities from the perspectives of small businesses and from the perspectives of non-immigrants and immigrants as well.
Thank you.
I think we have time for one more question.
And again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. And you do have a follow-up question from the line of Charles Erickson with News Service.
Yeah, do you have any comparable cost figures for how much it would cost individuals or the government to implement a program that would authorize all the folks that are in the shadows to come out through a federal program?
The estimates on it, if we were to do a legalization program, have actually been positive because folks would pay fees and fines, so it'd be a revenue generator. I don't have the amount in front of me, but that hasn't been a problem.
But they would have to. How much would it cost an individual who wanted to go through that program?
Through the legalization program?
Yeah.
It would depend on how it's crafted. So I don't know. I mean, the fees have really varied in different legislative proposals, and I don't have in front of me what the last version was, the 2007 bill, for example.
Okay. Thank you. Well,
and thank you, everyone. We will now wrap up. This concludes today's telebriefing. Thank you all for your interest in this very important topic. Special thanks to our presenters, Center for America Progress, Angela Kelly, Philip Wolgen, and to our telebriefing co-sponsors, The Opportunity Agenda. An audio briefing of this telebriefing will be available at the website www.americanprogress.org. And if you have further questions, you can reach them at 202-481-8181. Thank you all very much for your participation.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.